I think of the t-shirt that I've seen online, which reads, "What if Glenn Beck is right?"
Yeah.
He's
hey, look, even a broken clock is right twice a day. I want to have confidence in government, but this shatters you.
This week, one of Glenn Beck's conspiracy theories has turned out to be kind of true. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In a week where government surveillance of journalists was a top story, advice on how sources should call journalists nowadays.
Buy a couple of disposable cell phones, one you mail to the press. At a time written on the phone, you call the press, far from your home, far from where you work. And when you're done, destroy your cell phone and throw it away.
And evocative dispatches from a Civil War reporter who never actually saw the battle.
Bayonet, musket, sword, and cannon all did their bloody work, and the earth was stained and slippery with human gore.
All that and more, coming up next.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So this week we learned that the Department of Justice secretly obtained phone records of the Associated Press for April and May of 2012. Attorney General Eric Holder says the leak being investigated warranted the probe.
This is among most serious leaks that I've ever seen. It put the American people at risk, and that is not hyperbole.
That leak showed up in a May 2012 article that revealed how the government foiled an al-Qaeda attempt to blow up a plane, thereby refuting the government's claim that no al-Qaeda attacks had been planned for the one-year anniversary of the killing of Osama bin Laden. The next day, the New York Times and other sources reported that the conspirator whose task was to set off that bomb was actually a double agent working against al-Qaeda. Jeffrey Stone is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School. He says that the law is pretty clear when it comes to getting those phone records.
Yeah, there's no real question at all that what the Justice Department did here was legal.
The law does require the authorities to jump through a few hoops, right?
No. The Justice Department has its own internal voluntary guidelines. They have to go to the Attorney General or the Attorney General's designate to get approval to do this, which apparently they did. They have to have demonstrated that they have exhausted other reasonable means of obtaining the information, and they've certainly suggested that they've done that. We don't know all the facts about that, but it's a perfectly reasonable proposition that they've acted in conformity with their own internal guidelines.
So let's talk about what rights people have.
The Supreme Court held in the 1970s that we have no reasonable expectation of privacy in information that we have voluntarily disclosed to a third person. According to the conservative justices of the Burger Court, that included a bank with your financial records or a phone company with your telephone records and so on. I happen to think this is a terrible doctrine. The truth is, in modern society, we are required to share what otherwise would clearly be private information with third parties, and to suggest that the fact that we do make that information available indicates a lack of interest on our part of keeping the information private seems to me a pretty ludicrous doctrine, but it's the law.
So sending an email because you're going through a server is a third-party communication, but sending it through the U.S. mail is not.
Right. What's inside the letter is private. If you send a postcard, it's not private. Now, in this instance, I should say, there's one facet of this investigation that makes it less troubling than might otherwise be the case, because here all the government is getting are the phone numbers. It would be as if the government was looking at the addresses on the mail. This is not a case where the government is listening to the phone calls.
So the president suggested once again that Congress pass a federal shield law, it exists in many states right now, that would give more protection to the sources of journalists. This has always gone down. It'll go down again. And there are exceptions in it that would probably not have affected this case anyway.
I think that's right. I mean, my guess is that if the latest variations on the proposed statute were enacted, that the government probably could have done pretty much what it did here anyway.
It won't pass. Why do you think it should?
Because it's better that there be a statute than to be entirely within the discretion of the Department of Justice. I would go well beyond what the proposed statute requires. I think that the government should be subject to much greater restrictions in terms of subpoenaing reporters to reveal their sources or going after phone records, as in this case. There are circumstances where I think the government does need to find a source. And if they can demonstrate that a person is seriously dangerous to the nation, then I think demanding that the journalist turn over the information is reasonable. But beyond that, I would say no.
Now the Republicans are really mad at Obama's Justice Department for going after the AP. Not just Republicans, but also Democrats. Republicans have always killed that National Shield law. So you'd think maybe there'd be a chance to pass this law.
Well, first of all, the reason the Republicans are going after it is pure political hypocrisy. To suddenly go after this administration for doing something that they've called upon government to do ever since 9/11 is just completely hypocritical. And, of course, they won't vote that way. They absolutely won't vote that way because they don't believe in what they're saying. And they don't think it would be good for the nation.
I just wonder, in the president pushing this bill again this week, do you see the same? You worked for his election at one point and then became very critical of him on these precise issues. Is he being a hypocrite right now?
I don't think that's hypocritical. I think that's expedient. He's basically always been in favor of this statute. And I think it's just taking advantage of the fact that the Republicans are saying, you know, we should not allow the government to do this. And he's saying, okay, if you believe that, let's pass a law.
Jeff, thank you so much.
Good to talk to you.
Jeffrey Stone is a constitutional scholar and a professor at the University of Chicago Law School. So how should reporters and sources manage secret information when we all must use communication tools that have no legal privacy protection? Nick Weaver is a senior researcher at the International Computer Science Institute in Berkeley, California. He wrote a piece for Wired this week titled, "Hear Ye, Future Deep Throats, This is How to Leak to the Press."
You have to buy a new computer because your existing computer has so many things that track you. You go to some network cafe far from your house, walk because, well, we have license plate readers now, open up the computer, create a new email account, email to the press, turn off the Wi-Fi on the computer, clear all the browser cookies, close the computer. And now this computer you only use to contact the press, only from locations far from home.
Okay, tell me how you deal with a phone.
Probably the best solution is what Julia Angwin of the Wall Street Journal suggested to me. Go to some random liquor store in a bad neighborhood.
Why a bad neighborhood?
You want bad surveillance cameras. A liquor store has an old camera. The VHS tape gets recorded over every day.
You also suggest that people pay cash.
Of course, credit cards are traceable. Buy a couple of disposable cell phones. Turn them off and keep them off. One is for you, one you mail to the press. At a time written on the phone, you call the press from a location far from your home, far from where you work, talk what you need to do, and then when you're done, you destroy your cell phone and throw it away.
So how would you arrange for future meetings?
Oftentimes, you can just meet over the phone. As long as you're in a remote location, and you keep the phone off at all other times, that phone can't be traced to you.
Dealing with cell phones and computers, these are all 21st century solutions to 21st century problems. But as you note in your piece, there are old school solutions as well.
The U.S. mail is an excellent form of one-way communication. They don't record everything. If they're monitoring the recipient, even then they can only say this was sent from Berkeley or sent from Washington, D.C.
How about even older school, talking face-to-face? It's easy for cameras to pick up license plate numbers, but there are also face recognition cameras.
Face recognition is actually much harder than license plate recognition, and easy to screw up. Just wear a hat.
So, the U.S. mail, talking face-to-face, walking. Aren't they really going to slow down investigative journalism?
I think that is the point. We've had two administrations that view 1984 as an operations manual. This acts to dissuade future leakers.
1984, aren't you a little overwrought?
The surveillance apparatus that we've created in private industry would make Orwell ashamed. Companies you've never heard of are recording everything you do. All data that is just a subpoena away.
Nick, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nick Weaver is a senior researcher at the International Computer Science Institute in Berkeley, California.
This week, to help insulate journalists and their sources from government surveillance, The New Yorker launched a new service. It's called Strongbox. It was developed from code created by programmers Kevin Paulson and the late Aaron Swartz. According to NewYorker.com editor Nicholas Thompson, the two wanted to correct what they saw as an imbalance in the arms race between the watchers and the people they watch.
And they came up with this wonderful system. They built it, they tested it, and then Aaron Swartz committed suicide. And eventually it came to us, and we spent some time modifying it for The New Yorker, and we've just released it today.
What does it do?
It allows someone who wants to get a piece of information or a message to somebody at The New Yorker to do so with pretty good confidence that it will be impossible to trace them. That even if someone were to come to The New Yorker and say, "Who gave you that?" we wouldn't know and we couldn't tell them. Now, that creates its own issues. We need to verify that the documents are real. So it creates a burden, the fact that we can't figure out who sent them to us. But it also does have this benefit that if we don't know, nobody can make us tell them.
I'm trying to apply Strongbox to the current situation with the AP. Assuming that those reporters had some sort of relationships with their source before any sensitive material was transferred, had they had Strongbox in place, would it have made any difference?
It's possible that somebody could figure out that you'd communicate with the source. But what Strongbox does is it certainly makes the transfer of information much more secure. AP reporters and their sources certainly could have transferred documents, or they could have even transferred messages through Strongbox.
The fact that we're having this conversation really makes me sad, because journalists have to elude the prying eyes of the Justice Department.
For people who are really concerned about the state of communication, there are a couple of responses. One is to build new tools, and the other is to ask for changes in the law and to make arguments about changes in the law. I think it's a moment actually to be excited that technology has created this great opportunity for communication, and it's open source, so it can be used by multiple news organizations. I think there are an array of appropriate responses for the moment, and this is one technological one.
All right, Nick, we're speaking at about 5 o'clock on Wednesday. Strongbox was announced just a few hours ago. Do you have any incoming yet?
I don't know.
So it could be the Pentagon Papers awaiting you, or you have created the most paranoid slush pile perhaps in human history.
Who knows? We have some combination of the Pentagon Papers and cartoon caption contest entries that people really don't want to know where they came from.
All right, Nick, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Nicholas Thompson is the editor of NewYorker.com.
Coming up, how one financial news service provided the kind of insider information that just couldn't be found anywhere else, and how they got busted for it.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Air France, the official carrier for Marseille-Provence 2013, European capital of culture. A major attraction of the Provence region are the beaches of Nice and Cannes, which are known for sunbathing, discos, high-end shopping, and restaurants, whereas Antibes and the Cap d'Antibes, about halfway between Nice and Cannes, offer a quieter beach vacation. Tickets and information on daily flights to Nice and Marseille are available at airfrance.us. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create professional websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week saw the resignation of two prominent IRS officials after it was confirmed that the agency targeted conservative nonprofit political groups during the 2012 election.
It should not matter what political stripe you're from.
The fact of the matter is that the IRS has to operate with absolute integrity.
IRS Commissioner Stephen Miller was fired on Wednesday, and Joseph Grant, the commissioner of the Tax-Exempt and Government Entities Division, announced his resignation on Thursday. The departures were at least a partial victory for conservative bloggers. They've been covering the story for more than a year, and they've been mostly alone. The IRS scandal didn't really break onto the mainstream front pages until last week, after an admission of wrongdoing from the IRS itself. The Huffington Post's Michael Calderon wrote about the story's winding path, starting with its origin in the right-wing blogosphere.
Some conservative sites, like The Blaze and like Right Side News, they started saying, okay, you know, this is a group in Virginia, this is a group in Hawaii saying this. And the letters seemed remarkably similar and were coming from the same office in Cincinnati that is supposed to be investigating whether organizations should get nonprofit status.
And if the stories were there and they were reasonably well documented, why do you suppose the mainstream press didn't pick up on these blog posts in the right-wing media?
I think there is a hesitancy because there have been a number of cases where conservative sites will post stories that are later amplified by the Drudge Report and get on Fox News. And these stories suggest a conspiracy at the hands of Democrats or the Obama administration. And oftentimes, when you look into these stories, there's not nearly as much there as the headlines would imply there was. At the same time, if reporters had looked at posts like the one that Colleen Owens wrote on Right Side News, she's a Tea Party activist. She's not a reporter by training at all. She's actually a stay-at-home mom based in Virginia. She uploaded PDFs of the actual letters that these groups were receiving. So it wasn't just hyperbolic or bombastic language about how the government is trying to crack down on the rights of Tea Party people. Reporters could have found the actual primary documents, and that could have led to a lot more coverage.
Well, actually, though, there was exactly that kind of language in her pieces, in addition to the primary sources. And, you know, it's easy to understand when you go to the Right Side News and see crazy gold bug kinds of stories and vast conspiracies reported about Obamacare. It's not hard for me to see why this stuff would be dismissed with a wave of a hand. If the boy is always crying wolf, how do you know that this time it's a real wolf?
Right. I think the best thing to do is to kind of look at some of the primary sources, if there are any, and then, you know, make a judgment from there whether this is something to pursue. And a couple mainstream outlets the following month, after some of these stories on The Blaze and Right Side News, did put some questions to the IRS. And the IRS basically at the time said they're not looking into Tea Party specifically, that, you know, they're doing their diligence and following the criteria that they do when organizations want to apply to be nonprofit. So some reporters did look into it, but most of the coverage back in 2012 from mainstream sites was more along the lines of Tea Parties are claiming X, IRS is saying Y, and then the story sort of dissolved.
Do you suppose that the mainstream press now has the responsibility to spend more time combing through these more politically inflected blogs in case they are, in fact, detecting scandals that have not caught the attention of the outside world?
I think it's smart for reporters to be aware of what partisan sites, whether on the right or left, might be putting out there. And at the same time, you don't want reporters to go down the rabbit hole of spending all their day combing through conservative or liberal blogs to try to figure out whether there might be a story there. There are some very good conservative reporters like Bob Costa at National Review, and he's one who frequently is breaking news out of the Republican Party and the conservative movement, and those stories then get picked up very frequently by reporters at what would be considered, you know, more mainstream news outlets. And I think it's because the stories aren't overblown or overhyped, and there's no suggestions of malicious or nefarious intent at the hands of Democrats or the Obama administration.
How about you, Michael? Is Glenn Beck's The Blaze now on your news feed?
Well, I try to pay attention to what Glenn Beck does because he has a large following and things he says will get picked up. At the same time, for any viewer of his previous show on Fox News, Glenn would wield together all these various conspiracy theories. So when you see his site talking about whether Obama is at the heart of some possible scandal, there's going to be a likelihood that reporters might still tune that out, thinking, well, there's no there.
All right, Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Huffington Post reporter Michael Calderone. And here's Megyn Kelly and Dana Perino on Fox News.
I think of the T-shirt that I've seen online, which reads, "What if Glenn Beck is right?"
Yeah. He's hey, look, even a broken clock is right twice a day. And now the conservatives have been proven right. I want to have confidence in government, but this shatters you.
The government wasn't the only powerful body caught snooping in recent weeks. On May 10th, we learned that Bloomberg News reporters were using Bloomberg terminals, those omnipresent, seemingly omniscient financial data computers, to follow the comings and goings of users. Bloomberg LP, which owns Bloomberg News, currently sells access to those terminals to about 315,000 subscribers, each for about $20,000, which largely accounts for the phenomenal success of the company. Bloomberg has since apologized, but financial institutions are still nervous. For instance, J.P. Morgan is pushing to know just how much information reporters had access to. Neil Irwin of The Washington Post says that this scandal reveals much about Bloomberg's secret sauce for making money from professional moneymakers, by which I mean the people on those terminals.
It's basically anybody in the world of finance who needs to have instant access to information about what's happening in every corner of the financial universe, who's trying to trade on that information and make money off of it. It's only people who have a lot at stake. If you really want this entire network of information, that's what they offer. That's why they're able to charge $20,000 and why competitors have not been able to pick off that business.
And it isn't just stuff that's available elsewhere, right? They have a lot of original reporting.
We think about Bloomberg as a media company because if you're a journalist, it's kind of the narcissism of journalists. We read their stories. We know what they're writing. That's actually a small part of what they do and a small part of the reason they're able to charge $20,000 for a terminal. They do things that are very hard to do. They take all kinds of bond market data and currency data and give you tools to analyze it in new and novel ways. They also do things that others wouldn't even think to do. In Cushing, Oklahoma, there are these oil terminals. It's the largest crude oil storage in the Western world. The way these storage facilities work, the roofs rise or fall depending on the level of oil, because otherwise there'd be too much fumes and it could catch on fire. Mm-hmm. They actually send a satellite by these terminals twice a week to take photographs. And from the shadows cast by the roofs of these storage facilities, you can actually estimate the current inventories of crude oil in Cushing, Oklahoma.
That's just stunning. And it was the company's mission to be the first with this kind of granular information that ultimately led to Bloomberg News employees spying on users?
So part of what the news operation does is they are very fast on stories like who's going to be the new central banker in Hungary or, you know, what's happening in the market for Botswana's currency. What they've also been doing is focusing on what's happening with executive changes at big banks, who's being fired, who's being hired. They had a little help in doing that because the journalists could access information on what terminal subscribers were logging in or not. So if a trader was fired, Bloomberg reporters were able to access that information that he had not logged in for a couple weeks and asked what the heck is going on.
Do we know about any particular story that was the fruit of this kind of snooping?
There was a Bloomberg reporter in Hong Kong who noticed a Goldman Sachs executive had not logged in a couple of weeks, went to Goldman and said, "Hey, this person hasn't logged in. Is there a story here? Is he no longer with the company?" Goldman was furious about this. They couldn't believe that this information was available. It ended up in the New York Post, and before you know it, Bloomberg's getting yelled at from all directions. And apparently the same thing happened with J.P. Morgan last year with the London Whale, the trader who caused billions of dollars in losses for the bank.
So, as you note, the reaction by the banks has been swift and very loud. Do you think it'll have an effect on the company's bottom line?
You know, if you're a hedge fund, if you're a big bank, you want to maintain absolute confidentiality of everything you're doing. And any sense that that has been breached is going to cause lasting damage to the company. That said, in terms of actual cancellations or losing subscribers, there's no evidence that's happening so far. It certainly is something that their major clients are nervous about. You know, the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury, the foreign central banks, they all have Bloomberg subscriptions as well. It's how they get the data they use to analyze what's going on in the markets. And they're not happy. You know, they're looking into, did Bloomberg journalists have access to this information on what these high government officials were doing, when they were logging in, what types of data they were accessing? The Bank of England is particularly angry.
The Bank of England saying, quote, "The protection of confidential information is vital here at the bank. What seems to have happened at Bloomberg is reprehensible."
You've observed that this incident pits the two imperatives of Bloomberg's strategy against each other.
Right. So Bloomberg has built a very profitable company, a very large company, based on this interlocking information ecosystem. On the one hand, they want to be the first with the news that people in the financial world care about. And the key part of the news is the guy in the corner office going to get fired? And that's something that everybody in the financial world wants to know, and they wanted to know it yesterday. On the other hand, they can't endanger that client trust, because if they do, the entire house could fall apart and then they're in real trouble.
This is a sticky wicket for Bloomberg.
It is. They have changed the policy, so it is the case that journalists don't have access to this information anymore. But it's a sign of this strange world we're in. You know, if there's one thing we've learned this week from all of these different stories, whether it's the government or your data provider, the amount of data people can access about each of us is something that I think is a little scary. And the Bloomberg story fits into that that thing that makes us all a little nervous.
Neil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil Irwin is a Washington Post columnist and author of The Alchemists, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire.
Now, another tale of troublesome technology, this one raising the hackles of broadcast and cable TV. Though most of their content can be accessed online after a few days or weeks, it's still pretty hard to watch TV in real time on the internet. Well, a company called Aereo seems to have solved that problem. For a small fee, users can watch and DVR network TV from any device, their phones, their laptops, whatever. But Aereo can't just scoop up broadcast signals with a big antenna and redistribute them, like cable does, because without paying fat redistribution fees, they'd be in violation of copyright law. So instead, Aereo uses thousands of tiny antennas. The logic being that a one-to-one connection between a user and an antenna doesn't violate copyright law. Last month, the courts weighed in.
Aereo can roll out its service without paying the broadcasters or cable or satellite TV providers. A federal appeals court approved the legality of Aereo's business model.
After the ruling, the networks unleashed a volley of threats, including removing their content from the broadcast spectrum entirely.
News Corp threatening to take Fox broadcast off the air as part of this legal dispute if the courts back Aereo.
This week, Aereo, which previously operated only in New York, expanded to Boston, the first of some 22 cities on its list. In response, ABC has introduced a rival online real-time service in New York City and Philadelphia. Meanwhile, the networks plan to continue their legal fight against Aereo, arguing that its antenna system exploits a legal loophole. Not so, says CEO Chet Kanogia.
We don't think of it as a loophole. This is what the expectation Congress has had. Hey, spectrum was granted to broadcasters to program in public interest, free of charge. They make money in advertising and let the consumers have antennas so they can pick it up. We just basically took that and brought it into the modern age.
Some things are legal, but just strike you as being somehow unfair or wrong. And when I heard about your business model, I went, I can't believe this is kosher. It just seems so wrong. You know, I have a friend who goes to high-end dress stores and will buy a dress on a Friday for an event, wear the dress and return it on Monday. I guess it's legal, but it isn't right.
Let me give you a different analogy. What about a library? A library buys books without any permission and is allowed to rent them out to anybody as a public service and build ancillary businesses supplying video services, all kinds of different things.
Now, far be it from me to take the side of the cable companies who've been gouging consumers for decades, but it still seems to me you're exploiting a legal loophole to distribute stuff that just doesn't belong to you. Why am I suddenly, for the first time in my life, sympathizing with big cable?
The question I would ask is, do you think Radio Shack should be paying retransmission fees because they sell antennas? Do you think Sony, that has made billions of dollars selling televisions with tuners, should be paying retransmission fees? Aereo is a technology company that just does the same things that Radio Shack and Sony do slightly differently.
There's almost no point in me quibbling with you over these issues because it's already been litigated. You won a very important decision that says that this is not a violation of copyright law. Is it all over but the crying?
I don't know whether we will face more litigation or not, but we do think that the courts saw the technology, evaluated it on its merits, applied what Congress's intent was behind not only granting the spectrum, but also how the copyright laws are written, and there is a real focus on preserving what is known as a private transmission or a private exhibition for the consumers. So far, we've been fortunate that we've had a legal system that's been very fair despite the atmospherics.
So I've already expressed to you my sense of unfairness. Putting aside whether it's right or wrong, what if Congress has the same feeling?
I believe that there are lawmakers that view competition and fairness as a very important fabric of American business, and as a result, are going to be encouraging alternative choices, competition, because at the end of the day, the benefit is for the consumer.
There's already a big cord-cutting problem. People using their broadband to get the kind of programming that otherwise they would be paying their cable stations a lot of money every month to provide. Is this a big nail in the coffin of the cable business model?
A majority of the households watch 7 or 8 channels, and a third of the country watches network television only. And the problem is, just to get quality network television from a technological perspective with modern conveniences like a DVR, you're forced to take the entire package. So from my perspective, I look at it and say, this is an opportunity to recast how consumers are going to consume for the future. There is absolutely no reason why you need 17 channels of MTV when all you really wanted to watch The Daily Show.
A big chunk of revenue that broadcast stations get is from cable companies paying retransmission fees for what the broadcast stations are putting over the air. At some point, it seems to me, the TV stations themselves go away, and you've got nothing for Aereo to broadcast.
You know, we don't think that's how this plays out. I mean, think about the following. The median age for cable subscriptions has moved from 21 to 29. And if that trend continues, that's already going to happen. The inverse is Aereo brings the younger demographic into the marketplace, any device, any place, any time, and tremendous opportunity can emerge on top of that in digital advertising. When the VCR came out, the exact same hyperbole was layered in. You know, studios are going to die and you know, the world was going to end. And everybody made billions of dollars in home video.
Chet, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Chet Kanojia is the CEO of Aereo.
Coming up, how some in the past imagined journalism in the future. We'll fact-check their predictions of our present.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at MacFound.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, working to conserve a legacy of public lands for all Americans, at PewTrust.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As any regular OTM listener knows, we often discuss present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
But rarely do we visit the past to see what folks thought future business models might be. For instance, in a late 1960s TV special about the 21st century home, Walter Cronkite tackled the future of newspaper delivery. He got it half right, I guess.
This console provides a summary of news relayed by satellite from all over the world. Now, to get a newspaper copy for permanent reference, I just turn this button. And out it comes.
Matt Novak writes a blog for the Smithsonian called Paleo Future about futuristic forecasts from the past. He recently wrote about old predictions for the newspaper.
Some of the pictures that we get from past visions of the future have to do with the newspaper that would be delivered by radio. Fax papers, as they were called, were actually trialed in the 1930s and 40s, where you would have this machine that you'd set up in your house, but given the spectrum it was using, it could only be used from midnight to 6 a.m. So you had this loud clattering machine that would print out a newspaper while you were sleeping. A lot of the other predictions had to do with pneumatic tube delivery. That pneumatic tubes were a very popular vision of the future. Actually, the Boston Globe predicted in 1900 that not only would laundry or your ready-made lunches get delivered via pneumatic tube, but also your evening newspaper.
The bad guesses are entertaining. The prescient looks at the future are kind of jaw-dropping. You have written about a December 1900 issue of the New York World daily newspaper. It quoted the editor of another newspaper, the London Daily Mail, predicting the centralized national newspaper.
Yeah, exactly. Alfred Harmsworth, the editor of the London Daily Mail, was saying in 1900, I feel certain that the newspaper of the 20th century will be drawn into the vortex of combination and centralization. He goes on to say, in other words, where there are now a multitude of papers, good, bad, and indifferent, there will be then one or two great journals.
You've written about a 1994 video from Knight Ridder, which had a laboratory dedicated to developing the future. We're talking about 19 years ago, still pretty much the infancy of the internet, but they describe the iPad.
Tablets will be a whole new class of computer. They'll weigh under 2 pounds. They'll be totally portable. They'll have a clarity of screen display comparable to ink on paper. We may still use computers to create information, but we'll use the tablet to interact with information. Reading, watching, listening.
What's interesting about that Knight Ridder video is that it was actually used in the Apple versus Samsung patent war of the century here. You know, Apple sued Samsung saying that they were copying their designs for their phones and their tablets. And Samsung countered with, well, here's prior art. You know, this is your iPad. So it's interesting to see these sorts of futuristic concepts pop up in real-world disputes over intellectual property.
The tablet in the Knight Ridder video showed a newspaper on the page. It shows being able to click through to more details in the story. It showed being able to click through to video. It showed related stories that were immediately loaded onto the page. Just kind of nailed it. But it got one thing hilariously wrong.
We envision kiosks that will download your publications onto electronic cards that go inside the tablet. So if you're doing business in Miami, but your hometown is Denver, you can still get your local paper delivered every morning.
Completely missed. Completely missed. In the internet age, the notion of internet distribution of every paper.
Well, things like wireless delivery of newspapers were still the realm of sci-fi. There's a lot of accounts from the early 90s where people just didn't believe that broadband Wi-Fi would be a reality even within, you know, 20 years.
So you have made a study of these artifacts. I'm curious to know what your favorite prediction is, accurate or off target.
I often go back to the Jetsons. You know, they obviously had the jetpacks, the flying cars, the meal pills. They also had dedicated machines for every different technology that today we have sitting in our pockets, whether that was the video phone or whether that was the newspaper machine. You know, it descended from the ceiling and George sits down in his comfortable chair and reads the newspaper.
I guess the only thing the smartphone does not do is give you a dog treadmill outside the apartment. Matt, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate it.
Matt Novak writes the Paleo Future blog for Smithsonian.com.
Help! Help! Jane, stop this crazy thing! Jane! Help! Jane!
We'll stay in the past with a look at Civil War coverage, with a focus on the double-edged sword of embedding journalists with military units on the ground. 150 years ago, two journalists headed with Union troops to chronicle the attack on the Confederate stronghold of Vicksburg, Mississippi. It turned out to be just the beginning of a long and perilous odyssey. Junius Brown and Albert Richardson, correspondents for Horace Greeley's feisty New York Tribune,
didn't practice journalism quite as it's done today, but they did risk life, limb, and liberty in the Deep South to dispatch news of the Civil War to the North. Peter Carlson, author of Junius and Albert's Adventures in the Confederacy, says the reporters were odd bedfellows, but a formidable team.
Albert Richardson was a strong, stocky guy from a farm in Massachusetts. He could go anywhere, talk to all the important people, and get the story. Junius was the scrawny, prematurely bald kid with jug ears who had grown up in a rich family in Cincinnati. He read philosophy for fun. He was not a particularly good reporter. He was too shy. His modus operandi was to stand in the background and then write an ironic piece with a lot of literary references.
Well, let's listen to an example of Junius Brown's purple prose, one of his dispatches from the Battle of Fort Donelson, the Union's first big victory in the war.
Ever and anon, a loud cheer went up for the Union, and this was caught up at a distance and echoed by our soldiers and re-echoed by the surrounding hills. Many a brave warrior heard that glorious shout as his senses reeled in death and his spirit went forth embalmed with the assurance that he had not fallen in vain.
Now, there's a footnote, Peter, to this story. Junius, the scrawny little aesthete, apparently played a part in the victory.
Yes, Junius was with a group of snipers at the Battle of Fort Donelson, and they were trying to pick off the guys in a Confederate artillery battery. And the Union snipers kept failing to shoot them. So one of the snipers handed Junius a rifle and said, "Can you shoot?" So Junius aims, and when the Confederate pops up, he fires the rifle. And bingo, the Confederate battery stops firing. So the sniper says, "I think you fixed him that time." "I wouldn't be surprised," Brown replied, although, of course, he was completely surprised. He didn't know how to shoot.
I'm just trying to imagine a contemporary reporter using a weapon while embedded with troops.
There were no journalistic ethics in those days.
Later, Brown filed a story invented out of whole cloth, or at least stitched from little patches.
Yes, he did. Junius and a reporter from The World, Richard Colburn, were in St. Louis when they learned that the Union Army in Missouri had headed south to invade Arkansas. They were about 200 miles away when they began to get little telegraphed reports that there had been a battle, the Battle of Pea Ridge in Arkansas, and that it was very bloody and that the Union had won. They also knew that Thomas Knox of the rival New York Herald was actually at the battle and would no doubt be scooping them. So from their hotel room in Rolla, 200 miles away, Junius wrote a long purple story about the battle as if he had seen it too.
Bayonet, musket, sword, and cannon all did their bloody work, and the earth was stained and slippery with human gore. Every loyal soldier kept his eye fixed on his fearless leader. Wherever they saw his streaming hair and flashing sword, they knew all was safe.
And, of course, they were discovered and fired.
No, they were discovered, and everyone in the business was highly amused. Before they were discovered, Horace Greeley wrote an editorial saying how great the story was and that it should be reproduced and given to all Union soldiers. And later, the Times of London reported that it was the best story of the war. The press in those days made no bones about objectivity. Greeley was a mover and shaker in the Republican Party, and he had been a backer of Lincoln. He helped Lincoln get the nomination for president in 1860.
Well, this kind of advocacy would figure into the travails of Richardson and Brown. So let's get to the heart of their adventure. It began as they were embedded with Union troops on a barge on the Mississippi.
General Grant was going to attack Vicksburg, and if the Union took Vicksburg, they would cut the Confederacy in half. So Richardson and Brown were eager to get to Grant's army. So they got on this barge, which was bringing hay to Grant's horses, and they had to sail past Vicksburg. And the rebels just fired all their cannons from Vicksburg, blew it up, and Junius and Albert and those Union soldiers who were still alive jumped into the water and floated on hay bales, heading south. The Confederates sent out a boat and captured Junius and Albert and their friend Colburn from the New York World.
Now, as non-combatants, they expected to be quickly released. And the Confederate bureaucracy actually gave them parole papers, which entitled them to be exchanged quickly for non-combatants being held by the Union troops. Didn't work out that way.
No, it didn't. When they got to Richmond, they were put in Libby prison, and then all of the soldiers who were captured with them and Colburn were paroled, but Junius and Albert were not. When the Union bureaucracy wrote to the Confederates in charge of prisoner exchange, Robert Ould, the Confederate agent of exchange, wrote back and basically said, "We hate the Tribune and we're not releasing these guys."
It seems to me that if any exceptions be made as to non-combatants, it should be against such men as the Tribune correspondents, who have had more share even than your soldiery in bringing rapine, pillage, and desolation to our homes. You ask why I will not release them? 'Tis because they are the worst and most obnoxious of all non-combatants.
For the next 20 months, the Union kept trying to trade Confederate reporters for Brown and Richardson, and Ould kept refusing.
You discovered in the letters that they were writing back north the great deal of celebration about General Grant's victory at Vicksburg. That struck you as odd because...
because they didn't mention the victory of the Union at Gettysburg, which had taken place a day earlier and hundreds of miles closer. You would think they would have been celebrating that one, too.
But why weren't they?
Well, they were reading the Richmond newspapers, and the Richmond newspapers were informing their readers that the Confederates had won a great victory at Gettysburg.
Our army victorious at Gettysburg. The Yankee army retreating. The whole breed are as nervously fearful of gunpowder and bloodshed as women and Negroes.
They even ran Union newspaper accounts of the victory at Gettysburg, and then they would announce at the bottom that everyone knows this is a pack of Yankee lies.
Junius and Albert were in one prison and then transferred to another, and then finally they were moved to a prison called Salisbury.
And when Junius and Albert got there in February of 1864, they were thrilled because they had been kept in these stiflingly hot tobacco warehouses in Richmond. Now they were in Salisbury, which had a beautifully grassed yard with stately trees. In fact, they played baseball on good days. At that point, there were only a few hundred prisoners there.
In the beginning, it was kind of like the scene in Goodfellas, where Paulie and the gang were in prison making gourmet dinners and smoking cigars. What happened?
In the fall of 1864, the Confederates were besieged in Richmond, and they sent most of the prisoners there south, some of them to the now infamous Andersonville in Georgia, and others to Salisbury. So instead of having a few hundred prisoners, all of them housed indoors, you now had over 9,000 prisoners living in holes in the ground or crude makeshift tents. And it rained and it snowed and guys were starving. The Union Army had deliberately destroyed the breadbaskets of Virginia, so there was no food to feed the prisoners.
Junius Brown wrote about that in one of his letters to his managing editor, Sidney Gay.
About 1,000 have died, and mortality is on the increase. At the present rate of death, next August will find none of us alive. But then we will be free. Dante, with all his gloom and horror of his inferno, did not dream of that.
Junius and Albert volunteered to help in the so-called hospitals, which were basically just spaces indoors where very sick men would lie on the floor with some hay around them. Albert was made the clerk of the hospital, so he kept records of all the sick men and whether they died or not. Junius went out into the yard with the few medicines that they had and would crawl into the holes they were living in and give them some medicine and try to cheer them up. At one point, someone asked him what kind of physician he was, and he said he was an amateur physician. Many of the soldiers had no idea what that meant and thought that was some kind of higher degree of doctor because he seemed to be better than the ones inside.
At this stage, your book pivots. The privileges conferred upon them as volunteers in the hospital enabled them to just stroll outside of the prison and commence a 300-mile odyssey to freedom.
Yes, they knew that the closest Union army was in Knoxville, Tennessee. And they escaped on December 18th. It was very cold, and they had to cross the Blue Ridge and then the Appalachians. In the flatlands near Salisbury, they knew that they could ask the slaves to hide and feed them. In the mountains, though, there were very few slaves. It was mostly small farms. So they had to rely on a secret organization called the Heroes of America, a pro-Union secret organization with secret signals and handshakes. Those people would lead them from one safe place to another.
So over the course of about a month, they traversed snowy mountain ranges and at last found their way to Knoxville and the U.S. Army.
Albert's cold, he's wet, he's half-starved, but he has the presence of mind to send back a telegram. All it said was, Knoxville, Tennessee.
Knoxville, Tennessee, January 13th, 1865. Out of the jaws of death, out of the mouth of hell. Albert D. Richardson.
And it's a quote from a very famous and very popular Tennyson poem. So Greeley receives this, publicizes it, and they return to New York and write up the stories of their adventures.
Books that they turned around rather quickly, both bestsellers. These guys were sort of the Woodward and Bernstein of their day, only probably with better calf muscles.
Yes, they were. Richardson sold about 90,000 copies. Brown's maybe 70,000. That is a great sale even today.
Peter, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Peter Carlson is author of Junius and Albert's Adventures in the Confederacy, A Civil War Odyssey. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, Sara Durkman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson. We had more help from Ravenna Koenig and Alexandra Hall. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. And our boss, bassist composer Ben Allison, wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.